Lots of streams still run orange in our region from acid mine drainage. It's pollution, but it also contains something valuable used to make electronics.
In 2011, the prices of rare earth elements spiked, and so that instilled an interest in other sources of rare earth elements.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, there's actually more than one use for that legacy pollution. Some pottery making also takes advantage of those orange streams.
But yeah, this is just a liquid glaze.
Plus, there's a delicate calculation that goes into environmental regulations for air pollution. The number of jobs in coal and other polluting industries we're willing to save versus the number of premature deaths as a result of pollution.
There are very few people I think you'd talk to who are 70 who think it would be fine to die at 70 instead of 75.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A new study from a national environmental group finds that Pennsylvania's gas drilling industry is releasing a lot more methane into the atmosphere than it's reporting to the state. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Scientists at the Environmental Defense Fund calculated Pennsylvania's Marcellus shale industry is emitting twice as much methane as companies are reporting. David Lyon is EDF's lead scientist on the report. He said that companies' reporting doesn't account for abnormally leaky wells, but EDF's numbers, which are based on in-the-field measurements, do. Lyon says these faulty wells, so-called super emitters, are responsible for most of the industry's emissions of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas.
It can be hard to really find all the leaking components on a site, and if there are any really large emissions caused, you know, these things we call super emitters, they can be very difficult to measure.
Pennsylvania is the country's number two gas-producing state behind Texas. The EDF report found that about half of Pennsylvania's emissions are coming from its 70,000 older conventional wells. Lyon says that's probably because these conventional wells can be, in some cases, decades old.
One of the main reasons is just a lack of maintenance or less attention being paid to these wells that are more common and produce a lot less oil and gas than some of the newer wells.
The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is crafting methane regulations for Marcellus shale operations, but it has no such plans for conventional gas wells. EDF's county-by-county emission data for Pennsylvania is available to the public on its website. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
President Trump is not a fan of regulations.
We have begun a historic program to reduce the regulations that are crushing our economy. Crushing.
Trump's directed a lot of his anti-regulation rhetoric at the environment. According to the Washington Post, the Trump administration has targeted 63 environmental rules across all agencies. So what's the case for environmental regulations? Do they make our lives better? Or are they simply the job killers that President Trump says they are? For our latest Trump on Earth podcast, I spoke about the economics of regulation with an actual economist, Karen Clay, at Carnegie Mellon University. She's looked extensively at the Clean Power Plan, or CPP. That's the Obama-era initiative to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Trump wants to repeal it. I started my conversation with Karen Clay by asking her about the rationale behind this regulation.
The Clean Power Plan and most air regulations more broadly basically protect public health. And so what we do is we actually look at if you reduce air pollution by some amount, how many fewer people are sick in terms of hospitalization or lost work days, how many more people are not dying as a result of the regulation. Most of the regulations are passed because there are significant public health benefits that we believe outweigh the costs of the regulation. One thing that's really important to recognize about the Clean Power Plan is, although a lot of people think, oh, it's only about reducing carbon dioxide, most of the benefits in the Clean Power Plan are actually local environmental benefits from reduction in air pollution. Yes, there are some benefits from improvements in deferring climate change, a lot of the benefits really could be sold as it's helping you, it's helping your neighbor. And so there are a lot of benefits.
The Clean Power Plan was supposed to reduce emissions from mostly coal-fired power plants that contribute not only carbon into the atmosphere, but other things that we breathe in, like PM 2.5.
That's right. And so although most of the benefits are focused on PM 2.5, because that's a pollutant that we understand relatively well and are certain adversely impacts human health, there are lots of other benefits that derive from that, including reductions in things like lead emissions that aren't even included in those calculations, in part because, different coal has different sort of trace element numbers, and in part because the benefits from reductions in PM 2.5 are so large that you don't really need to think about these other benefits.
When it comes to the economy, then the benefit is that fewer people will be sick, and so fewer people will miss days of work. Your people will be using healthcare benefits.
Yes. And one way to think about the Trump administration's focus on jobs is implicitly what they're doing is they're trading off jobs for lives. And so one thing we want to think about as a society is, how do we want to trade them off? Is one job equal to one premature death? Is one job equal to, five premature deaths? Or are 100 jobs equal to one premature death? And so I think we need to have a clear conversation about those trade-offs in order to better understand what we might be getting if we're saving 100 jobs or 1,000 jobs. The other thing to keep in mind is that when we think about premature death, we sometimes think that these people are dying, say, a week earlier. But in fact, they're not. The available evidence suggests that they're dying about 5 years earlier than they would otherwise. And so there are very few people I think you'd talk to who are 70 who think it would be fine to die at 70 instead of 75. So there's significant loss of life associated with air pollution. And so these increases are really, potentially bad news if they come to fruition.
Those jobs, according to the Trump administration, or at least what President Trump said a lot in speeches, are coal jobs, coal worker jobs. He's been very outspoken about saving the jobs of coal workers.
We're preparing bold action to lift the restrictions on American energy, including shale oil, natural gas, and beautiful, clean coal, and we're going to put our miners back to work. Miners are going back to work.
Yes, he's been very focused on that. And the only thing I would say is the number of coal workers is not huge. And so in many cases, he's going to need to be saving some other jobs as well. Despite the efforts of the current administration, coal has not been doing all that well, because the economics of natural gas are incredibly compelling. It's just cheaper to produce electricity with natural gas.
Did you write a piece in Vox about the number of jobs versus the number of people who might die if the Clean Power Plan isn't implemented?
So in the Clean Power Plan, this Obama-era climate change policy is expected to reduce deaths nationally by about 3,600 in 2030 due to fewer pollutants in the air. Valuations that are conventionally used by economists suggest that one premature death corresponds to between 50 and 150 jobs in terms of economic contribution. The problem with that calculation, if you take it at face value, is that the number of jobs saved by repealing the Clean Power Plan would have to be between 3 and 10 times the total number of coal miners in the United States today. Job creation or preservation of that magnitude is just very unlikely.
Karen Clay is a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. There's more of our conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's where you can find all of the episodes of the Trump on Earth podcast, TrumpOnEarth.org. Later in the show, we'll look more closely at some health impacts for coal miners and Trump's review of federal regulations to prevent black lung disease. So stick around for that. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 25 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in environmental science, master's in environmental science and management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
In Appalachian coal country, thousands of miles of streams run orange with pollution. It's called acid mine drainage. But if some researchers have their way, that and other coal waste could produce valuable products called rare earth elements. They're essential to many high-tech products. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board has the story.
Paul Zimkevich is standing in front of a silo full of crushed limestone that slowly gets flushed into a stream pouring out of an old coal mine here. It's a state-of-the-art, state-operated facility that treats acid mine drainage. If it weren't here, the stream would run rusty red, killing ecosystems in its path.
Okay, so we're at the Omega Mine, and the Omega Mine is about 4.5 miles south of Morgantown, West Virginia. And it's an area that's been heavily mined for coal since the Civil War.
This year, Zimkevich, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute at West Virginia University, was awarded $2.6 million federal dollars plus funds from the private sector. His research aims to locate, isolate, and commercialize select hard-to-gather elements of the periodic table, elements that are critical to the technology age we live in. Some of those elements can be found in acid mine drainage.
I finished up some calculations that the acid mine drainage production in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Eastern Ohio can supply anywhere between, and this is in terms of rare earth, somewhere between 800 tons per year to maybe 2,200 tons per year. 800 tons a year is basically what the military needs for defense purposes and contractors.
Zimkevich and a handful of other scientists in and around the Ohio Valley make up the majority of the American team dedicated to cracking the rare earth element puzzle. That is, the team that's on the hunt for rare earth elements and how to build an industry around them. The Americans are the underdogs. Right now, China is the team to beat, where 95% of the rare earths used in phones, electric cars, and smart bombs are all sourced.
In 2011, the prices of rare earth elements spiked, in part because of a supply problem from China. And so that instilled an interest in researching rare earth, other sources of rare earth elements throughout the world, but also in the United States.
Tom Tarka is the technical project lead for rare earth elements at the National Energy and Technology Laboratory in West Virginia, or NETL. He explains about 140,000 tons of rare earth elements are produced globally each year into products on the market. There's no commercially available alternative for sourcing rare earths outside of China. And since the U.S. doesn't want to have to rely on any single other nation to provide important components critical to national security, government funds are funneling into research at NETL in Morgantown, a national lab that focuses largely on coal and fossil fuel research. Mary Ann Alvin is the head of the rare earths division there.
Right now what we have is actively 15 programs, 15 projects that are investigating not only separations, investigating where we can find our best reserves, and how can we take this forward.
Rare earth mines have tried and failed in the U.S. already. They just weren't profitable on their own. The hope now is that rare earth mining can be economically viable if it piggybacks on other mining operations, like coal. Tom Tarka from NETL explains that researchers have already begun to identify rare earth elements in and around coal seams, as well as those within waste products associated with mining and burning coal.
In Appalachian coals, especially Southern West Virginia and Central App, we're seeing more heavy rare earth elements. And that's good because these heavy rare earth elements, they're rarer and they have an increased value as a result.
The thing is, rare earths are not rare so much as rarely concentrated and hard to extract. It usually takes acids and harsh chemical processes, which create the stuff of environmental nightmares. But as Paul Zimkevich at the Water Research Institute knows well, West Virginia is already coping with environmental nightmares.
Before the Clean Water Act, the Monongahela River at Morgantown was orange, and it had a pH of about 4.2. It was absolutely dead. There was hardly anything alive in it. The only difference between then and now is the amount of treatment that water gets before it winds up in the river. In the Mon River Basin, I think something like a third of all the acid mine drainage is actually being treated in industrial size operations.
So acids are literally seeping from coal mines everywhere throughout Appalachia and apparently leaching rare earth elements in the process.
It turns out that the more acid seams give us the best results because it has the most pyrite. Pyrite in turn generates the acid that leaches the rare earth side of the rock.
Simkevich's research is not only identifying which elements exist in acid mine drainage, or AMD, and the sludge left from treatment of polluted water, but also how to process the elements and get them into a marketable form.
Rather than sludge disposal being a liability, if you could actually make some money on it, and it's probably not going to pay for all of the costs of AMD treatment, but if it knocks down the cost by 20, 30, 40%, that's a very, very significant incentive to continue treating acid mine drainage.
And Zimkevich is just one researcher. Others in Kentucky and Pennsylvania are studying lots of other coal waste products like coal ash. There are literally mountains of discarded coal ash throughout the region. Coal scientists estimate that with continued research and the right economic pressure, a rare earth industry in the Ohio Valley could exist in 10 to 20 years.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Glynis Board.
We'll hear about turning acid mine drainage pollution into something artier a little later in the show. But first, another legacy of the coal mining industry, black lung disease. Howard Berkus is an investigative reporter with NPR who's been focused on workplace and coal mine safety. His most recent story follows up on his 2016 investigation into complicated black lung disease in Appalachia. Howard, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Most people have at least heard of black lung disease in our region. You've been reporting about complicated black lung in Appalachia. What's the distinction?
Complicated black lung, or progressive massive fibrosis, is the worst stage of the disease, or several worst stages of the disease. It is marked by much larger what are called opacities on the lungs. It is severe in the symptoms. It's incurable except for a lung transplant, and aside from getting a lung transplant, it's fatal.
Epidemiologists at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, recently reported a very high number of complicated black lung cases in a concentrated area. How many people are we talking about, and why is this significant?
In the study that that NIOSH just produced, they looked at three clinics in southwestern Virginia, which serves coal miners from Virginia, Kentucky, and West Virginia. And they identified and confirmed 416 cases of the disease in the last few years, or the previous few years. The study ended about a year ago. And that's an astonishing number. NIOSH itself, in its own accounting of that disease, found less than 100 cases in the same time frame nationwide, and here in just three clinics in southwestern Virginia, there are four times as many cases. NPR has been surveying black lung clinics across Appalachia, and our count is up close to 2,000 cases in the same time frame that NIOSH had previously identified only 99. So this is, NIOSH itself now recognizes this as the worst cluster of this disease ever documented. NIOSH has referred to it as one of the worst industrial workplace disasters in American history. And it also marks what is a sharp increase in the disease from the 1990s, when researchers believed that it might actually become extinct.
Edward Brown is a former coal miner. He's featured in your story, and he has advanced black lung. He's 55 years old. Let's hear a little bit from him.
Can't breathe, you know. Can't do nothing hardly like I used to. That's all I got to look forward to get worse and worse, you know. It just, nobody looks forward to dying, you know, but it's a coming, and that worries me.
Edward Brown is like a lot of the coal miners we've been talking to. They describe lives that have been seriously diminished by this disease. Just the act of answering questions is extremely difficult for them. You can hear them struggle for breath. The breathing is labored. We have talked to miners who tell us they've watched fathers and uncles die from black lung, and they describe it as slowly suffocating to death.
How do researchers account for men as young as Mr. Brown, 55, some in their 40s and even 30s, being diagnosed with this disease? What have you found?
It used to be the coal seams were massive and big, and the mining machines were simply cutting coal. But the big coal seams have pretty much played out, especially in southern Appalachia. And what you have left are coal seams that are embedded in rock. And that rock in that region tends to be sandstone or quartz. And when you end up cutting rock and coal together, which the technology now permits, you end up with silica particles in the dust that's created. And silica is far more toxic than coal dust. And inhaling silica, any particles of silica, those particles will stay in your lungs forever. And it starts to, the lungs start to react to that silica by building up fibrotic tissue, which eventually becomes progressive massive fibrosis or complicated black lung.
Now, the Trump administration wants to begin what they're calling a retrospective study of newer federal regulations that limit exposure to coal and the silica dust. These were finalized under the Obama administration. And I believe that this retrospective study is being called deregulatory. What does this move signal, and what could it mean for miners?
So the concern is, what is their intent? And the word deregulatory signals an intent. Now, the head of the agency now, David Zateslo, who's a former coal mine executive, insists that there's no intention to cut back on the regulations. And the retrospective study that they're undertaking is something that the Obama administration did make part of the new rules. They wanted to go back and check on how things were working to make sure they were effective. And that's what Trump administration says it intends to do.
What about the people who are sick who and dying and their families? Does this rise to the level of a public health crisis?
Well, some people say that this is a public health emergency, given the large numbers of miners now being diagnosed with the disease, and that more should be done, that that the Department of Health and Human Services should declare a public health emergency and send in nurses and doctors and health professionals to diagnose miners, to get them tested, to try to catch the disease earlier. That's not happening. There is resistance, especially in a Republican Congress and a Republican administration, to do anything, number one, that would seem to require more regulations for mining, or that would cast doubts on the importance of coal mining and might cause coal mining to decline even further.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you for your interest in this story.
Howard Berkus is an investigations correspondent with NPR, and there's a link to his most recent story about complicated black lung and more stories about its impact on coal miners in our region at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. So those bright orange streams that we heard about earlier, tainted with iron oxide from mining, might be bad for fish, but good for something else. Artists and craftsmen are using the dried and powdered iron oxide material to color T-shirts, wood, concrete, and even the burnt sienna shade of Crayola crayons. A few years ago, the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan visited a nonprofit that's helping turn creek contaminants into pottery glaze.
Yeah, this is just a liquid glaze.
Potter Bob Eisenberg dunks a mug into the grayish liquid.
it's manganese.
A lot of times I'll just kind of do it, just shake it around a little bit.
He's always used iron oxide and manganese in commercial glazes that come from around the world. A few years ago, this local alternative became available.
I think because they had larger particles, they did different things. They just were kind of runny, and they had a little like feathery details to them that our other glazes just didn't have.
About a half hour's drive from Eisenberg's studio is a double-wide trailer where Eisenberg gets his supplies. It's the headquarters of Stream Restoration Incorporated in Mars near Pittsburgh. The organization helps 20-some watershed conservation groups keep their water treatment systems up and running. Margaret Dunn and Ryan Mahoney walk around the back of the trailer.
Okay, Ryan, can you explain what we have in these sacks in the back?
Sure. When a system kind of reaches an age where it's getting clogged or there's too much manganese or iron in it, we go out and recover the materials. For the iron, it's kind of go get some interns or people from the office and shovel it into the bags. So it's kind of a dirty process.
Then they spread and dry it out. The groups pulled more than 20 tons of iron and manganese out of just a couple streams. Mahoney demos the next step, flipping on a commercial sifter.
Basically, once you turn it on, you just put the material in and it shakes and distributes.
The potters ask for particular sizes?
Yeah, some potters like larger sizes, some like raw materials, some like it very fine. It's going to be a little loud.
This whole operation came about after Dunn had a surprising conversation a few years ago.
Back in about 2005, my best friend, who is a potter, she recognized the material that we were collecting in our systems when we were treating mine drainage could be used by potters. She made a few pieces, and now we have 7 potters that contribute. And all the money from the sale of the material and from the pottery goes to help watershed groups sustain the treatment of their systems.
They call this project Clean Creek Products. Inside the trailer, Dunn shows off pieces made with glaze. They're artsy modern works, naturally, in earth tones. $20 to $30 for mugs, $25 for a set of earrings.
I typically wear some. I should have had some on today.
A sake set, flasks, and tea kettles round out the collection. And if it seems counterintuitive to drink from a cup made from what pollutes streams, well, Dunn explains it this way.
We've had the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, we've run tests to make sure that it could be used in the pottery safely and for food, and it meets all the criteria. And we were just surprised.
Do people ask that, though? Like, wait a minute, this is what's polluting streams.
You know, if you're taking a multiple vitamin, you're taking iron and manganese. When there's too much iron, then fish can't live. You know, it tends to kill the stream.
When she thinks about the implications, Dunn actually gets choked up.
I'm originally from southern West Virginia. There's a lot of poverty down there, a lot of mine drainage. And anything to help the communities is what we want to do.
That story was produced by the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.